It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Kelly Oxford is a little bit wicked and a whole lot wild and funny. In no time, she went from being a housewife and mother of three in Calgary to internet fame through her blog and later through Twitter, where her popularity exploded. There, she shared zips like, how do you get red wine stains off a baby? And if you can name five Kardashians but can't name five countries in Asia, stick a knife in an electrical socket. She's been retweeted by Jimmy Kimmel, John Mayer, and even the late Roger Ebert, one of her earliest supporters. Kelly Oxford's first book is called Everything is Perfect When You're a Liar. Now, it's not a collection of tweets. It is a series of outrageous vignettes about her life so far. But she does accommodate her Twitter fans with a list of things she'd like people to do for her at her funeral.
1. Stuff my bra for me. 2. Play the Game Over theme from Super Mario Brothers.
Far from a funeral, Kelly Oxford's rebirth as a writer is taking off in a big way.
Play the videos of North Koreans crying for Kim Jong-il and pretend it's for me.
All right, I'm going to write my own tweet here. Kelly Oxford on Weekend All Things Considered has new book, movie, TV pilot, lives in L.A. now. Hashtag don't hate her. Kelly Oxford, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you've got this great new memoir out. I'm wondering about the title of the book. It's called Everything is Perfect When You're a Liar, because you make it clear in these stories that you're a terrible liar.
I'm a terrible liar. I really believe that the only way that anybody can have a seemingly perfect life is if they're covering up a lot of their life and they're lying to everyone and perhaps sometimes themselves. So that's where the title came from.
Your Twitter fame starts to pay off when you discover that David Copperfield is a fan of yours. And you parlay that into this free room and a free show in Las Vegas. And I love the way you describe meeting Copperfield. You say he's tall and he's broad-shouldered and he has these beautiful bedroom eyes of Osama bin Laden. How was the magic close up?
The magic was insane. He put me right at the front of the stage. I was just thinking, there's no way they're going to be able to pull off these illusions where they can mess up. I mean, I was right up against the stage. And then he did this one illusion that still to this day, like I would love to watch it over and over and over and just analyze it, because he laid down in one of those, you know, magician-like coffin boxes, and from both ends of the box, it was spinning around so I could see underneath of it. And there was one person on each end pushing the box in. So his body was shrinking. So his head was getting closer to his feet. And they were getting closer and closer and closer and closer until it was the smallest box with just his head sticking out of one end and his feet looking like they were coming out of his neck. And at that point, I was like, oh, my God, I just met this guy like 30 minutes ago and he was totally normal. And I'm going to have to hang out with him in like another 15 minutes after seeing this. Like, it was just, it was such a surreal moment seeing that.
I love that you had this absolutely stage side seat to an experience, seeing a man shrink into something almost like, I had in my mind, a shoebox spinning around and around.
Yes.
And I thought, this is like a dream, or maybe it's like the end of a really bad work day.
That's right.
Kelly, talk to me about honing your craft. You're in your mid-30s. You had your first baby when you were 23. At that time, you were only kind of erratically, although it was fun, working in TV and film projects in Canada. But you have known what you wanted to do seemingly since your lungs first filled with air.
Yeah. I think that I was, you know, when my mom told me what the internet was, I think in 1993, and I was in high school, and I just instantly knew that this was a place that I could put out material. And, you know, even though I didn't really recognize it, the audience that I did have online, which was, you know, a little under 10,000 people would get emails when I would blog through all of this. Mm-hmm. I was using them, you know, as a sounding board, telling me what they liked, what they didn't like. So, you know, a good analogy, I guess, for that would be the stand-up comic, you know, that
right.
gets on stage and tries out new jokes. Oh, this works. This didn't work. I don't think a lot of writers that publish books or write movies get an opportunity to use an audience to their benefit. And somehow I managed to do that this entire time.
You were interactive before you even really heard a whole lot about that. You know, there are millions and millions of tweeters out there, and it's really tough to cut through the noise. When did you start to realize that what you were doing was actually connecting with people?
Really, really early on. I joined in March of 2009, and by the end of that summer, I had, you know, comedians following me. And by the following spring, I had a very large following of people in entertainment following me. And I had been invited down to Los Angeles to be a part of a night of 140 tweets, which was a benefit for Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
It was 140 celebrities reading one tweet. And I was the only non-stand-up comedian or actor or, you know, working writer that was there.
Boy, you have to tell me your tweet.
Oh, my God. I don't even remember what it was. Let me think. It was, I always watch Law and Order because I think my future attacker is watching it, too, and I want to be a step ahead of them.
I do think your tweets are absolutely sensational. I don't know. I just love how you get red wine stains off a baby.
Right. The simpler they are, the better they hit.
Do you think that women have a certain permission to really be funny now? I mean, when Dorothy Parker was writing, you know, it was almost considered shocking at what a quipster she was.
Yeah. You know, since Bridesmaids came out, I think that a lot of things have changed for women in comedy. Same with girls on HBO. I mean, in Bridesmaids, we saw women getting sick, and we've never seen that in a film before. And I think that was a really big turning point. And for that movie to do so well at the box office, I think has really opened a lot of doors for female comedians because, you know, now the big bosses and the businessmen can say, oh, people actually will pay to see women be funny and crazy and in crazy situations.
Yeah. When you started with Twitter, did you have these kinds of expectations? Did you seriously think, wow, this is my ticket?
No. Never. I mean, look, I've been online since 1993, and I would brag to people about having 7,000 people getting an email about a blog that I'd written, you know, and this was in 2001. I had no idea. And it wasn't a goal for any of this to happen. I was a very happy homemaker with, you know, two kids and eventually three. And I was just so satisfied having an audience. And, you know, to me, having just under 10,000 people interested in me online pre-Facebook was just such a huge success to me that I would still, if I was in that position, would just be sailing right along at home, you know, making pasta and picking up my husband at the train station every day.
That's humor writer Kelly Oxford. Her first book is called Everything is Perfect When You're a Liar. And you can read an excerpt on her website, npr.org. Kelly Oxford, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The collapse and rebirth of Somalia has been a long battle, and women like Dr. Hawa Abdi have been on the front lines. Abdi has been nicknamed the Mother Teresa of Somalia, and she has a new memoir called Keeping Hope Alive. Back in 1991, when the Somalian government collapsed, she was a young doctor operating a small clinic on her farm with her family south of Mogadishu. As the conflict raged on, Dr. Abdi's clinic grew into a 400-bed hospital and ultimately a refugee camp. At the height of the war, 90,000 displaced Somalis made their home around Dr. Hawa Abdi's hospital. It was an island of peace she defended from militants and, as she told us recently, an oasis she fought to maintain for people who had lost everything.
They are very angry and mentally not fit when they are coming to you. They have seen when their parents or their brothers, their wives, their fathers were killed in front of them. They are coming to me. There is no government. Whole society became violent.
How did she do it? With the help of the community of refugees that embraced her philosophy of equality above clan loyalty. Today, the camp and hospital are run by her daughter. She also became a doctor, trained in both Russia and the U.S. Her name is Deco Mohammed. Mother and daughter stopped by our studios while on a visit to Washington. Deco Mohammed explained how life has changed at the camp.
The war stopped in Somalia, whole Somalia. And it's the first time I have been in Somalia for the last 6 months. I haven't heard any gunshot for at nighttime. You might hear it daytime, but you could sleep peacefully. And we're getting back to the life in our village. School is opening. The hospital is renovating. So it's a lot of work is going on. It's a busy life.
Do you feel like a mayor or a governor instead of yes. a doctor?
Yes.
Yeah.
She's
yeah,
now a governor and doctor and teacher also.
Deco, describe for me a typical day for you. You wake up in the morning, and what do you encounter during that day?
At 6, we do the hospital round, inpatient. You know, I run all the errands in the hospital, and I do managing of the camp and farm and everything else from 7 to 10. Then 10 to noon, I do take care of gynecology, because I'm the only female doctor now in the hospital. If there is any fight or any misunderstanding or any dispute in the camp, you have to be present sometimes. It's very fluctuating days, and you do work 24 hours.
Just like mom.
Yeah.
She's doing her job now. That was I want that she would be. And I'm very satisfied now that she's working like that. Although my time was very difficult than her time.
During your time, during the height of the conflict, 92, 93, what was your typical day like?
Oh, at night, each clan was going to another clan's people. They were attacking, and some people were dying. Others were wounded. I was trying to give a first aid and to talk with them, just some mental comfort.
Which is very essential.
Very, very difficult. Even seeing their face was very painful. That moment was very difficult for me.
There were rules in the camp, in the hospital, in the early days. What was it like trying to enforce a rule that people couldn't bond through clans or talk about their families? I mean, how could you really enforce that in the midst of essentially clan warfare?
The necessity is mother of invention. So it was no other way. So when they came, we were informing them, if you use the clan division or you say, I am that clan, you cannot stay here. You will be Somali. And you will stay, and we will welcome you.
Over time, do you think people's attitudes, people who were staying with you in that community, that their attitudes changed at all?
Totally changed.
Really?
Totally changed.
They didn't do it just because, I mean, you're giving them free food and...
free land.
And, yeah, land and medicine,
Yeah, you're a clan. It's not giving you what I'm giving you. Just they are coming when you are wanted to do destruction or killings. They will help you. But your life, they are not helping. So they obeyed us. And we succeeded that rule.
Did people in the community also serve as police?
Yeah.
They helped you with this enforcement?
Yes. The kids are enforcing. Now they're not kids who came to the camp when he was 10 and now he's 30 years old. Grown-up man who is reinforcing the rules and taking care of everything. We are very blessed, I think so.
Deco, did you have moments when you're in medical school where you didn't want to come back?
I did. And it's a normal nature. Even if I grew and I was very passionate when I was in medical school, I need to do this in my country. Everything I have seen, like simple thing, when you're in a school and you see the patient in emergency room, they have every specialist, they have every equipment. And you know, okay, I wish we could have this thing in my country. And situation was deteriorating in Somalia. That's why I came to U.S. as a refugee. I came here hiding 3 years and studying and say, okay, I need to have my moment. And anyway, I went back because they needed me, because I have to be there.
At this point, you said there's a generation of young people who have been raised at your village and hospital. What are your concerns for them? What worries you about this generation that was raised during Somalia's collapse?
I want them to move on. I want them to take part of society, to be part of society, not only in this village, and go out and get work and have your life. And it was good. My mom created a beautiful camp and village, but they kind of isolated the rest of the country because they get used to this peace and comfort. Whenever they try to go out, they come back or they get 100% corrupted. We had young people, we lost it in the war, and they become war soldiers. So for one hand, it's very difficult for them to move on. it was good for temporary, now you have to move on.
It sounds like your hope is that eventually there won't be a need for Hawa Village.
Yes, that's what you're hoping.
Deco Muhammad and Dr. Hawa Abdi, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hawa Abdi's new memoir is called Keeping Hope Alive. It was co-written by Sarah Robbins.
Julia Sweeney is a figure of bi-coastal sophistication. She's a comic actor who does one-woman shows about love, illness, faith, and family. She's still fondly remembered for her androgynous character, Pat, on the glamorous Saturday Night Live. So how does she wind up in Wilmette, Illinois, driving a minivan and dreaming of solitude? Julia Sweeney's put some of her musings on becoming a Midwestern mother after adopting a little girl from China. My wife and I have two daughters from China. Then finding love and getting married into a new book, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. Julia Sweeney joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
How and why did you become a mother before you even knew that you'd have a spouse?
Well, I think I was a little disillusioned with success in Hollywood. Like, I had some success. I was on Saturday Night Live, and I had some failure. I did the It's Pat movie that, while I liked it, no one else seemed to. And
I would, had I seen it, I would have liked it. But that was the problem, I guess, right?
That was the problem.
Yeah.
I think there's about 8 people who've seen it. And then my brother Michael was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and passed away. I had cancer, and just show business seems sort of empty and demanding and superficial. And then my joke to myself is, but that was before I knew how superficial and demanding family can be. So at the time, it seemed like family was this way to connect in a much deeper way. And actually, that's true. I don't mean to make light of that. But as you know, family is everything, the spectrum.
Yeah. There are, as I don't have to tell you, labs and all kinds of wizardry they do nowadays to help people have children. Why did you decide on adoption?
Well, I personally don't see that it's that important that my DNA goes into the future. And I think there's a lot of children out there that need parents. And I have to say, even though I have a lot of friends who've done this, people who go to great expense and effort and also even endanger themselves physically in order to have a child, I don't get it. I just don't get it. I mean, just get a human.
Yeah. I will add parenthetically, sometimes when people are looking at our children in public and say they're so adorable or so bright or something like that, I'll say, well, you see the advantage of skipping my genetic contribution, and they get horrified. Like, how could I dare acknowledge the obvious, you know?
Well, I feel that way, too. I think there's probably great things in my DNA and also a lot of crappy things, and that's probably true for everyone, but that makes me think it's just a crapshoot with anybody.
And how did you wind up with an international adoption in China specifically?
Well, at the time, I was single, and China was a great place for single people to adopt from because you didn't have to be married. Now I think I would have been more open to doing a U.S. adoption, but at the time it just seemed like the thing that everyone was doing, it fit into my desires. I felt deeply about what was happening to the girls in China because of their one-child policy. So many were ending up in orphanages or dead, and I wanted to be part of that solution. It just seemed like a perfect fit to me.
And I'll leave it to you to tell us the name of your lovely young daughter.
Her name is Mulan, like the movie. That's right. She was named Mulan a year after the Disney movie.
Do you have any explanation for this?
I don't know. I was totally ready to let my daughter have her Chinese name. I thought, she's coming with so little, but she does have this name. This is one thing. Then they tell me her name is Mulan. Well, I work in Hollywood. I can't have a kid named Mulan. Like, this, people will look at me and go, is this like the only Chinese name you could think of? Like,
That's right.
I couldn't.
Sea Flower Drum Song. There are plenty of names in there.
Oh, my God. So I came up with the name Tara So I named her Tara Mulan. I kept her middle name. But then when Mulan was about 3, we were at a park and this man said, "What's your name, little girl?" And all of a sudden, as I said Tara, she said, "Mulan." And then she sort of looked at me like, "You can call me Tara, but I answer to Mulan."
You and your daughter, now that she's older, talk about origins, talk about race.
Yeah. We're getting into that more now. It's actually a complicated thing when you adopt someone because you're acknowledging my family, but also acknowledging how she became part of this family.
And now that you are married and have a family, and look, reading the book, I am, for whatever my opinion means, utterly convinced you were a wonderful mother on your own. But now that you're a family, is there something to be said for that combination of two?
Oh my gosh. See, that comes to another shocking attitude I have that I didn't expect. I don't think it matters what gender the people are, but I really think kids are better off with two adults committed to their welfare. It isn't even necessarily coupledom. Like, I think if you had family close by that you liked, that would suffice. But I think it takes a family. And I'm surprised that I have that attitude.
Did becoming a mother change the view that you had of your childhood?
Oh, tremendously. I always say it's the best thing that ever happened to my mother that I became a mother. Because I know I sound so sweet, but I can be quite a harsh judger. And I really relaxed my attitude about my mom in a significant way. Like, when I think that my mom had 4 kids in 5 years and then had another kid a few years later. And for example, like, my father was sort of a gourmet cook, but he was a once in a while gourmet cook where he would bring out the wok. And that was very exotic for us in Spokane to have food out of a wok. And I would tell people how my father was such a great cook. But my mom got dinner on the table in 30 minutes. When there were 7 people hungry, she got dinner on the table. And I did not appreciate that at all. Like, and now I'm just, my mouth hangs open thinking of how hard that is to do, night after night.
Julia Sweeney, her new book, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
In his epic saga of Middle Earth, the English author J.R.R. Tolkien creates a vivid land of elves and dwarves, wizards and hobbits, and at the center of it all is the One Ring of Power.
Evil is stirring in Mordor. The ring has awoken. It's heard its master's call.
Yeah, this is quite a ring. It can make you invisible. It also can create separation anxiety. Whoa, okay. So it turns out this ring could be real. Now on display at an English estate is the ring that may have inspired Tolkien's books, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. We spoke to Dave Green. He manages The Vine, the estate that houses the ring. Dave Green, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And so you may really have the one ring to rule them all.
Well, it's certainly a ring that may have inspired the story about the one ring.
Uh-huh.
It's a gold Roman ring found less than 3 miles away from where I'm sitting now. And it's a ring that Tolkien at some point was asked to comment on because of its archaeological value. And then less than a couple of years later, he started writing The Hobbit.
When and where was it first discovered?
It was found by a farmer who was ploughing his field in Silchester, which is an area that's known for its Roman activity.
Okay, so this ring is found by a farmer in the 1700s. And there's an important inscription on the ring. Is that right? What did it say?
It says the name of who the person we think owned it at some point, Zenithianus, and it says, "Live long in God."
And as I understand it, the fact that that name was on the ring ties it to something else that was discovered at an archaeological dig.
That's right. It ties it to the cursed tablet.
That's right. There is a cursed tablet that's part of this story as well, and it might have also inspired Tolkien. Green says this tablet was found decades after the ring was discovered at another Roman site more than 100 miles away. The curse was apparently inscribed by someone who had lost a ring, calling upon the Roman god Nodens to punish the person who might have stolen it. The name Zenithianus is mentioned on both the ring and on this tablet, and Green says that's where Tolkien comes in.
Well, in the 1920s, before he was so well known as a writer, Tolkien was actually known in Britain as being a real expert on Anglo-Saxon culture and their linguistics and writing. And so he was asked to comment on how this curse might have been and to comment on who was this god Nodin. So he was called along to inspect the tablet and would have had awareness of the ring. Another sort of link in the story, which just makes it seem as though this could be very likely, is that the area of Lydney where the lead tablet was found was also known as Dwarf's Hill, and it was said that that's where the dwarfs did their mining. And so, again, the story of Dwarf's Hill at Lydney tying in with the idea of a stolen ring, a cursed ring, it all starts to sound rather familiar to me.
It does seem like a hypothesis coming together. How is it that this ring is just now being shown to the public?
To be fair, it has been on display before. It was displayed in our library, but to be honest, the day when I thought we really need to make more of this story, I was walking around trying to show somebody where it was. Actually, it was really difficult to spot. And they said to me, you know, what a fantastic story. This is really good. I'm sure the world would like to hear about it. At that point, it was like, yes, we need to do something about this.
You have a ring that might be cursed. Does that cause people to sort of steer clear of it?
It's quite funny because everybody always jokes about whether any of us have tried it on.
Uh-huh.
And to be honest, I haven't, no. As my job as the property manager, it's really important that people don't see me almost playing with the collection.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about this.
Nice to speak to you.
That's Dave Green. Nice name, by the way.
Yeah, great name.
He is manager of The Vine in Hampshire, England.
April is the cruelest month. So begins one of the most famous poems in the English language. So maybe to take the edge off of April, the Academy of American Poets chose the month as a time to draw attention to the art and legacy of poetry and the achievements of American poets. So here on Weekend Edition, we'll celebrate this month by hearing from younger poets about how they chose or were chosen by poetry, and for that matter, why poetry, one of the oldest human art forms, still matters. We're starting the series with a luminary, a great teacher, too, Tracy K. Smith, who won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for her collection, Life on Mars. She teaches at Princeton and joins us from the studios of KWBU in Waco, Texas. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Are there people who still cite poems that change their lives?
Oh, I think so. I happen to work with a lot of young people who have poems that are changing their lives that they're eager to talk about. But every now and then when I meet someone, maybe someone of my parents' generation, and I tell them that I write poetry, they'll begin to recite something that they memorized when they were in school that has never left them.
What are students writing about these days?
Well, a lot of students start out writing about what's, you know, on the surface in front of them, which has to do with dorm life and college experience. But as we push forward into the semester and as they read more, they start to think about things that maybe take them out of their own points of view.
So do you tell them that even if they're a hedge fund manager, poetry can play a role in their lives?
I do, yeah.
Maybe especially if they're a hedge fund manager.
Yeah, I feel like we all need poetry. The moments in our lives that are characterized by language that has to do with, you know, necessity or the market or just, you know, things that take us away from the big questions that we have. Those are the things that I think urge us to think about what a poem can offer.
Do they have to rhyme?
No. I want them to think in a way that feels more natural and more in keeping with the lexicon in which they live. And once they get a little bit of facility with that, then I say, okay, now what would happen if you were to take some of these thoughts and questions that you live with and ask them to bend to the requirements of a traditional form? And sometimes really wonderful things happen.
Let me ask a practical question on life as a poet. If you happen to walk into the Volkswagen dealership and decide you want to buy something and you're filling out the forms, does the salesman say, oh, poet, great?
Well, I, you know, in those kinds of situations, I think it's really convenient to put professor as the profession. You know, on airplanes and in social settings, the poet comes up first as the vocation, the profession. But on those dotted lines, it's usually something that has an institution behind it that makes the most sense.
Children seem to connect with poetry quite naturally. Maybe it's the love of wordplay at a time when they play with everything in life.
I think children live in metaphor. I love the kinds of things that my daughter will say from time to time. And I wish that there was a way, or I hope that there's a way, that maybe as a poet I can encourage her to maintain that kind of perspective and that kind of love of play and of likening one thing to another without even realizing that's what she's doing.
Can you give us a poem?
I'd love to. Speaking of my daughter, this is a poem called When Your Small Form Tumbled Into Me. I lay sprawled like a big game rug across the bed, belly down, legs wishbone wide. It was winter, workaday. Your father swung his feet to the floor. The kids upstairs dragged something back and forth on shrieking wheels. I was empty, blown through by whatever swells, swirling, and then breaks, night after night upon that room. You must have watched for what felt like forever, wanting to be what we passed back and forth between us like fire, wanting weight, desiring desire, dying to descend into flesh, fault, the brief ecstasy of being. From what dream of world did you wriggle free? What soared and what grieved when you aimed your will at the yes of my body, alive like that on the sheets?
That's a beautiful poem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tracy K. Smith, who is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning collection Life on Mars. Thanks so much for being with us, and happy Poetry Month.
Happy Poetry Month to you, and thanks for having me.
And tomorrow on Weekend Edition, we'll hear from Nicholas Friedman, a poet and English lecturer at Cornell. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.